Good morning, this is Paul Ingram of PainScience.com. It is Friday, March 10th, and this is a reading of today's big member-only post, Can the Mind Create Pain? How do you know if your pain is psychosomatic? Can your mind create pain? Can we have pain for psychological reasons alone? Does pure psychosomatic pain exist? That is, pain with no injury, no issue in the tissue, no noxious stimuli of any kind. And finally, the most concise way of phrasing all of this, can we hallucinate pain? My short answer so far is probably not. Not as far as I've been able to determine. And I've tried pretty hard. I've been trying for a long time. The mind can harm us in ways that lead to pain in time. And it might be able to amplify pain. But so far, I've been unable to find any clear evidence that the mind can generate pain from nothing with no injury or pathology at all. And then there also seem to be several reasons to suspect that it isn't possible. Let's err on the side of does not exist. If psychosomatic pain exists at all, pure all-in-your-head chronic pain is probably quite rare. Unexplained chronic pain is often inappropriately, prematurely chalked up to psychology, and often for terrible reasons like sexism and racism, with terrible outcomes. In a great many cases, there's a biological cause that simply hasn't been diagnosed yet. In other words, most patients need better diagnosis, not fixes for a non-existent psychological issue. So we should avoid a diagnosis of psychosomatic pain like the plague. It should be one of the last things we think about if we ever do. But it's really important in principle, and it's interesting, to know if it's possible for the mind to generate pain out of nothing. And that's why I've written this, because I'm fascinated by it. And because as I spend months and years writing about all kinds of pain issues, it just comes up again and again and again. Could it be psychosomatic? And I've been increasingly uncomfortable over the last few years realizing that I don't know if it could be psychosomatic. I can't actually answer that question. It's become a real thorn in my side, this not knowing. So this is the serious beginning of a long process of trying to figure that out. This is a sloppy post, though. It's only the beginning. It's a half-baked draft. Great sales pitch, hey? I have usually worked my tail off to make most member posts very premium. My best work, high polish, cream of the crop. I'm pretty neurotic. I'm a writer. Most writers are neurotic about what we write. And I want to put my best foot forward, always. But I also always meant to share more sneak previews of works in progress, invite members to look behind the curtain, see content in development, and even contribute to that development. I am going to get useful replies to this post. Maybe some angry, useful replies to this post. You, dear reader, are going to supply examples and analogies I have not thought of yet, studies I haven't seen, arguments I haven't considered. So why don't you hit me with your best shot? Hit me with your best shot. Fire away. But even half-baked, this post is another couple thousand words, and it's not really all that sloppy. I'm not exactly a beginner with this topic. This is just the first time that I've tried to put it all in one place relatively rigorously. So there's some new content here. There's stuff I wrote this morning. There's stuff I wrote yesterday. There's stuff I wrote last week. But there's also stuff that I wrote last year and 5 years ago. It's a mix. So let's get into it. First up, can't stop believing, the psychosomatic paradox. And yes, that's two musical references in a couple of paragraphs. Amazingly, no one actually knows for sure if psychogenic pain is a genuine phenomenon. Sorry, I'm just correcting a rather egregious typo there. Certainly no one wants to believe that their own chronic pain is psychogenic. An all-in-your-head diagnosis or obnoxious subtext has become a cliche of medical gaslighting. I think it's fair to say that the words all in your head may be among the most hated words in all of medicine. Ironically, despite that hated phrase, almost everyone does believe that it is possible for pain to be all in your head. The whole idea of mind-body medicine is a smash cultural hit. So, that's a weird paradox. What is it? Do we believe or don't we? Can pain be all in our own heads or just other people's heads? And if we don't think pain can be psychosomatic at all, then what's with all the best-selling self-help books about mind-body medicine, the endless torrent of fear-mongering rhetoric about the evils of stress? It's bizarre how obsessed we are with a theory of health that every chronic pain patient also seems to loathe. The scope of this article. This article is focused on the all-in-your-head pain. Psychology is certainly a factor in chronic pain, especially anxiety, stress, and depression. Specifically, those psychological issues are particularly implicated. Many kinds of pain have their roots in long-term health issues that have complex interactions with mental health and personality. So, for instance, a very simple example of someone who's really out of shape, has metabolic disorders, at high risk for diabetes, heart disease, etc., lots of systemic inflammation, early onset arthritis because of that. This person, you know, by the age of 50 is probably going to be in pain because of who they are and the life that they have led, which of course has all kinds of things to do with their personality and their mental health. So there's definitely links. There's definitely connections between psychology and pain, but these are very indirect connections. There's also relatively little doubt that pain can be amplified by the mind, or at least complicated in ways that are almost indistinguishable from amplification. And there's also no doubt that suffering and emotional distress can make the experience of pain much worse. So all kinds of links between psychology and pain. But this article, this is about the evidence and arguments for the existence of pure psychogenic pain occurring in the perfect absence of any pathology or trauma of any kind, any relevant pathology or trauma of any kind. I probably can't find a human being who has literally no pathology or trauma of any kind. That human probably does not exist. But no relevant pathology or trauma of any kind. I will consider pain amplification and other kinds of psychosomatic illness only insofar as they inform this very focused central question. Some terms. The psychosomatic pain glossary. I got six of them here for you. All of them have just a short sentence as a definition. So just so you know what I'm talking about, because I'm going to use all of these terms quite a bit, and particularly as the article evolves and gets longer, these will be even more useful. And some of this very basic for some of my readers. Others will appreciate the clarity. So going through quickly, sensation is the conversion of a physical stimuli into nerve impulses, and then some kind of conscious awareness of that stimulus. Nociception is just a type of sensation, a specific type. It's the conversion of noxious stimuli into nerve impulses, which may or may not lead to pain. Sensitization is the increased nociception relative to stimulus. So the same stimulus producing a stronger sensation, that's sensitization. There's a bunch of different mechanisms for that. Perception is the organization, interpretation, and conscious experience of sensations. Amplification, this is the trickiest one. Pain that is out of proportion to a noxious stimuli due to perception. This is distinct from amplified pain syndrome, which is a label that has been stuck on a lot of children with unexplained chronic pain and is a more specific and problematic idea. The word amplification... Sorry, I promised only a sentence of definition, but this one has more. The word amplification isn't generally used in the scientific literature on this. It is used. It does crop up here and there. But the idea of pain being perceived as stronger than its associated sensation isn't formally called amplification. but it is a concept that comes up again and again and again with various labels. I've chosen amplification for lack of a better term. It works. It's a pretty good one. Suffering, last one, a negative emotional experience. And it's really, that's just included here because it's such an important part of pain, but also not the same as it. Okay, now that we've covered some terminology, let's get on with it. Proving psychogenic pain requires proving a negative, which, as everybody knows, is tough to do. There is no reasonably direct evidence of pure psychogenic pain, as far as I know. All we seem to have is speculative arguments mostly based on inference and extrapolation from other phenomena, or even phenomena. Probably phenomena. If X is possible, then maybe psychosomatic pain is also possible. To be sure that pain is psychosomatic, we must also be sure that it has no undiagnosed biological cause. But we can only ever be quite sure of that at best, and we are rarely at our best in this way. Most professionals are, apologies to the health professionals reading this, most pros are ignorant of the scope of possibilities and tend to underestimate them. It's not an insult. This is ignorant in the neutral sense. People are unaware. We cannot all read everything, and pain has way more causes than most people, you know, most healthcare professionals do not even begin to imagine how much they're not reading about pain. My favorite personal anecdote about this is the neurologist I consulted for my thunderclap headaches. I have an issue with thunderclap headaches, still do. And that neurologist, once he had determined that I didn't have a brain bleed, declared that I was fine because there were only a couple of other causes of thunderclap headaches and I didn't have the scary one. Therefore, false alarm, nothing to worry about. However, I had just finished reading a scientific paper. It was probably still on my laptop in my bag while I was talking to him. And that explored well over 100 distinct pathological causes for thunderclap headaches. Wow. I mean, there's a lot. There really are a lot of causes of thunderclap headache, and this neurologist didn't know hardly any of them. He basically only knew the ones that are most famous, a handful. And yet there really are dozens and dozens of distinct types of thunderclap headaches. And I don't think this means he was a bad neurologist. He was probably a very good neurologist when he was focusing on other things that he knows more about, but he just hadn't done the reading on this. And we all haven't done the reading on one thing or another. There's always something we haven't done the reading on, and you could do the reading on pain all day long every day and still not get the full picture. So that's what I mean when I say that most professionals, most people, all of us, period, all humans are ignorant of the scope of possibilities and tend to underestimate them. Right, so countless hard-to-diagnose causes of pain out there, and much about the physiology of pain remains mysterious. Some chronic painful conditions rarely have known causes. For instance, a staggering percentage of back pain is classified as nonspecific or not attributable to any specific cause. And there's been a running battle for decades now over how many of those cases have a biological cause or trigger that just can't be easily identified versus a psychogenic cause. Is it 60-40? Is it 30-70? We do not know, and we can never really know. So the point of that section was, we got to know that there's no biological cause. If there is, it wouldn't be psychogenic pain, but it's really hard to eliminate a biological cause. Just in general, super difficult, especially in any one case. It can be basically impossible to know. And now for the next impossibility, which is trying to separate psychosomatic pain from suffering and alarm. This is another basic limit on our ability to know if the mind can create pain. It's nearly impossible to tease apart pain and suffering. Pain is entirely subjective. It is what people say it is, and we can't contradict them. but the intensity of the pain that people report can be a product of either a more intense sensation and or its emotional significance to them. And that's not pain. That's the experience of pain. That's the psychological context of pain. Does someone say that a pain is a 6 out of 10 on the pain scale because the sensation is actually that strong, or because they are freaked out, or both? It's probably both, but in what proportion? It's different for every person and every problem, and there's never any way to know. And it is entirely possible that most of what gets labeled as psychogenic pain is just pain that has a fairly high percentage of panic and alarm out of proportion to the seed or trigger of legitimate pain. There is a pain sensation there, but people who tend to, you know, put a bunch of drama on top of that are quick to get labeled by healthcare professionals as having a psychosomatic problem, but they still have pain. That's the point. And it's impossible to know that they don't. The puzzle of pain's subjectivity. How can we know if pain is too loud? This is very closely related to separating pain from suffering, but it is distinct. Again, pain is subjective, and it can't be wrong. No one can tell anyone that they aren't in pain, or shouldn't be. Technically, we can't ever know that any one example of pain is too loud, because there's never a knowably right, that is, objective amount of pain for any situation, or even a fully knowable situation, because there can always be a sneaky cause that we can't detect or just haven't. This puzzle can't be solved any more than we can ever really know if someone is seeing reds too redly. This is, you know, basic amateur philosophy hour speculation about perception. We can't know other people's experience, and the pure subjectivity of pain places an absolute limit on our ability to judge whether it is amplified. But don't be fooled by this. This is a technical limitation that we have ways of working around. It's no different than what psychiatry has always had to grapple with. Pathologies that obviously exist, and yet they only have subjective symptoms. So how do we diagnose those? How can we know that a patient's experience is quote-unquote wrong? By how much it's at odds with the reality that we understand from other people, and by how much distress and trouble it causes. If someone is extremely tormented by the perception of things that no one else can perceive at all, we call that mental illness. And no one worries too much about the fact that we can't actually prove that it is. Not at the extremes, anyway. Wonky perception is where the color in life comes from. And there's all kinds of trouble with milder mental health issues. We can ask lots of interesting philosophical questions about whether or not, you know, those feelings and perceptions are wrong. But when it's extreme, when perceptions are causing suffering and are very strongly different from our shared reality, that's when it becomes a problem. You can't live with someone who is trying now. I want to be careful how I say that. I'm improvising at the moment, and I'm improvising out of my lane. Maybe I'll just shut up. Yeah, that's a good idea. I had written down the basics about how psychiatry diagnoses things. I should stop there. I will finally add that life is all about these good enough guesses. This is how it goes when we diagnose someone with a mental illness, because it is more or less clear that we can't perceive the things that they do, and it's really causing trouble for them. That's a good enough guess. That's, you know, we can't know that their perception is wrong. Hey, maybe they're right and everybody else is wrong about what's going on, but probably not. Okay, I meandered too far out of my lane there, but getting back to it, let's wrap this section up with the example of electrosensitivity, a clear example of a painful mental illness. People who report great pain and suffering caused by something that cannot plausibly harm them. In any one case, we cannot technically prove that their pain is wrong. And yet we can have very high confidence that the electrosensitive cannot be all right. Most of them must be reporting pain that has no biological cause. Maybe, probably. I'm going to revisit this again further along. Psychosomatic pain versus pain without nociception. Some readers are going to notice that the question of the existence of psychosomatic pain is just another way of describing the debate about whether or not we can have pain without nociception, which is a staple of dorky shop talk on social media for the last few years. The concepts do overlap greatly, but there is one key difference. The ideas of psychosomatic pain and pain without nociception definitely have a different vibe. Psychosomatic strongly implies mental illness, a pattern of lasting and consequential symptoms, whereas examples of pain without nociception are more often like brain farts, little isolated glitches in perception, more like being fooled by an optical illusion than a hallucination of pain. So finally, maybe too far into the article, we get to a list of arguments for pain without nociception. I've got, how many of these have I got here? 8 so far. I have 8 of these. These are all briefly summarized. And then below that, I have, I go into more detail about some of them. These ideas all come from an absence of good evidence that pain can exist without nociception. Instead, this is what we've got. Various arguments and suggestive examples and lines of indirect evidence instead. They're all interesting in their own right, but also none of them seem to be quite up to the task. They all have issues. First up is psychological stress and anxiety are implicated as major factors in almost every imaginable kind of health problem, and the weight of those examples is so great that it often seems to people, I think, like it's just a no-brainer that stress and anxiety must be able to cause pain as well. However, it's clear that there's usually or always an intermediate causal mechanism, such as muscle tension or an ulcer or poor fitness. In other words, we might hurt because stress and anxiety cause or aggravate a painful illness or poor health. I'm not aware that psychological stress and anxiety can cause pain directly through misperception. Boot nail guy is the best example of these kinds of examples. A case study of a fellow who experienced great pain because he thought a nail had gone through his foot, but in fact it had gone through his toes, right between them. We simply don't know enough about exactly what happened to understand this example. I've written in detail about boot nail guy elsewhere, but the bottom line is he's suggestive, but definitely not conclusive or compelling as far as evidence of psychosomatic pain goes. Phantom limb pain seems like an example of pain that exists entirely in the mind since the hurting tissue no longer exists. Except it does. It's the severed nerve endings in the stump that generate the nociception, and the brain just can't figure out the signal. It's clearly just an example of misperception of the location of the arm, not an example of pain without any nociception at all. The nociception is there, it's just being misinterpreted. And this is quite well established and documented. Can't emphasize strongly enough that phantom limb pain has been trotted out as an example of pain without nociception on countless occasions. And it's just, this, I think, is the only one here that's just, it's just flat out wrong. It is not an example of pain without nociception. It is an example of weird perception, but not of perceiving nociception that ain't there. Nocebo is the well-documented phenomenon of fear-powered symptoms that seem to show that psychosomatic pain is possible. It might be one of the best arguments for psychosomatic pain, but it's also not quite the slam dunk that it looks like. More below. The phenomenon of sensitization can be used to make the case that pain can be generated from nothing, especially the phenomenon like, especially allodynia, pain from non-noxious stimuli. There's, you know, literally, you know, you stroke the skin and it feels like a bee sting, which, by the way, I have experienced. It's lovely. However, sensitization involves sensory amplification, a stronger signal, not stronger perception. Maybe this is another example of an argument for psychosomatic pain that's just wrong. Sensitization, definitely a thing, but not an argument for psychosomatic pain, because it isn't about perception. If it was just about perception, we would not call that sensitization. We would call that amplification. Although perhaps that's debatable. Central post-stroke pain is a promising candidate for pain that unambiguously comes from a bad brain and definitely not peripheral nociception. So it partially and vividly meets one of the key criteria for psychosomatic pain. And in that sense, it can definitely be considered hallucinatory. So we're very close here, but we're also so far, because that's the brain, not the mind. Pain that arises from brain damage, central neuropathy, and not psychology. So, still not psychosomatic. The functional neurological disorders. This is people who suffer from blindness, paralysis, or seizures without pathology, just psychology. This is one of the most vivid demonstrations of the power of the mind, but it's also not a direct analogy. They don't involve novel perception. The FNDs don't involve seeing or perceiving things that aren't there. They involve, as the name implies, changes in function. So not sure that they quite do it. They're certainly fascinating. They're certainly a strong demonstration of the power of the mind, but they don't demonstrate that the mind can make up pain. Hallucination, like actual hallucination, does happen, however, and this has led some people to suggest that if you can perceive other things without stimulus, then you can probably hallucinate pain too. And this is quite compelling on its face, but the deal breaker is that other kinds of hallucination always have a biological cause. As far as I know, either pathology or drugs. People perceive things that aren't there, that is a thing that happens, but they do it when their brain is impaired or altered, not because of their psychology. So it's a lot like the central post-stroke pain in that sense. It's a brain thing, but not a psychological thing. It's not their psychological. People don't see things because they have psychological issues. They see things because they have neurological issues. And probably some subtle ones that we don't know much about as well, too. So it probably can be very sneaky. Electromagnetic sensitivity. This is the last in the list, and actually my favorite. It's a real illness in which people report pain in response to something that can't actually harm them, which might mean that their pain is psychosomatic. Unfortunately, this isn't a slam dunk either, because it might also mean that they all just have an undiagnosed pathology. So basically, they're fibromyalgia patients, people with chronic widespread pain. And the EMS thing is just a tragically embraced hypothesis, something that they've taken on to explain their pain. Once that hypothesis is embraced, the obsessiveness and paranoia about EMF is a very natural consequence. It follows. If you believe that that's what's hurting you, then you're going to get obsessive and paranoid about it. Unfortunately, that gets them labeled as mentally ill, and now you have the assumption of psychosomatic illness, where in fact there's really something wrong with them, and there always was. And it's just the misdiagnosis of EMF is just a huge distraction. And that's my list so far. There's no chance that this list is complete, and this is the most obvious way in which this is a work in progress. I await your can't-believe-you-didn't-mention-it emails. Okay, now a little more detail about some of those. Nocebo. Is nocebo the example that we're looking for? Placebo is relief from belief, and nocebo is the opposite, grief from belief. Just as placebo is widely believed to be a fascinating example of the power of the mind over the body, so too is nocebo thought of as a vivid example of a psychosomatic phenomenon. If nocebo is a thing, and that is widely accepted, then psychosomatic pain is probably a thing. Seems pretty straightforward, but is not a clean win. It's not that nocebo doesn't exist, it's more that it's not what it seems like. Here are some of the complications. The legend of placebo is that it is powerful, but it probably isn't powerful. Not in the psychosomatic sense, anyway. Expectation effects appear to be limited to perception and are quite modest. Much of what is called placebo is not an expectation effect at all, but merely the appearance of it in a research context. Placebo is a lot of things. Placebo is a poorly defined word that refers to several distinct phenomena, most of which have nothing to do with the power of the mind over the body, and nocebo is the mirror image. Same issues. Just because placebo might be able to reduce the perception of existing pain doesn't mean that nocebo can generate perception of pain from nothing. So basically, placebo is working with something that's already there, changing the perception of something that's already there. But nocebo, to be proof of psychosomatic pain, would have to actually generate perception of pain where none is there to begin with, and that's quite different. Even if nocebo is a legitimate phenomenon, it may be limited to amplification of existing nociception, as opposed to causing the perception of pain in the absence of nociception. Most nocebo probably occurs in the context of existing pain. Did I just write this? Is this totally redundant? Yes. Yes, it is. but then I go on to say that nocebo may be about increasing suffering and drama about existing pain and not pain itself. So let's say that there is already pain and nocebo makes it worse. I need to rewrite this section. This is a little muddled and a bunch of overlap between the concepts of pain from nothing versus modifying existing pain. It cuts both ways, and I should explain that better than I have. Okay, so anyway, I've made the point that there are some complications with nocebo. It isn't straightforwardly demonstrating that psychosomatic pain is possible. There are impressive examples of placebo that are hard to dismiss, and my favorite is Beat Guy, which is a story from the excellent book Pain by Marnie Jackson. It's about a man who was rescued from agony by learning from his doctor that his bright red poop was caused not by internal bleeding, but beets. So where did all the agony come from? Certainly not the beets. Is this an open and shut case of psychosomatic pain? It kind of seems like it on the surface, and it's very easy to read the story as I have for years and just assume, oh yeah, that is totally psychosomatic pain. But after thinking that way about it for years, when I sat down to write this, I realized that I was overconfident in calling that psychosomatic pain because it's really hard to distinguish pain from panic, as discussed above. This may have been all panic and no pain. And then the other complication is that he might have actually had simultaneous indigestion. And kind of like the electromagnetic sensitivity, there is pain, it's just explained wrong. Right? He was actually in pain. He had some moderate amount of abdominal pain. The poor guy had, just had a poop. And sometimes poops are uncomfortable. Sometimes we hurt, especially in the aftermath of a poop. So maybe there was pain. Maybe he actually had pain. And then he believed that it was caused by, that it was related to quote-unquote bleeding. And that caused a lot of drama about it, but he was in pain. That's totally plausible. That scenario is completely plausible. I've been scared by beet poop before. It's happened to me. And beet pee. I've looked in the toilet and thought, oh shit, but I didn't hurt. I didn't have the experience of pain just because I thought there was blood in the toilet. Why did this guy? I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. You could potentially have psychosomatic pain from this. But I certainly haven't. And it's equally plausible that this particular patient actually had some abdominal pain and then got freaked out by the perception of blood, by the mistake of thinking that that was blood. And that would make it not an example of psychosomatic pain. Right then. Okay, that's nocebo. Whew, this is a long one. Most of my reads, most of my posts are not this long. By the way, this is about 2,500 words, and there's 2,500 words more of notes that aren't included yet, but will be in time. This is a big and complicated topic. Just a couple more sections. Indirectly psychogenic pain, from mind to insert something to pain. I think that this happens a lot. I think that there's a really common misattribution of pain to the mind because the mind is involved, but there's some intermediate mechanism. It's not the mind generating the pain directly. It's the mind doing something, and the something then goes on to cause pain. So, for instance, tension headache is a common minor example of how mental state can drive pain with no clear intermediate mechanism, and this kind of pain is often rounded up to psychosomatic. But there probably is a mechanism for all headaches. It's just murky, and we don't even know if it's quote-unquote tension. I think that this is the case for many painful conditions. There's clearly the mind is involved, but it's not causing the pain directly. It's doing it via some other mechanism. Holding your hand over a candle isn't an example of psychogenic pain, but why not? It was your foolish mind's idea, but no one in the right mind would say that it was your mind that caused the pain. It was the candle, obviously. What if you replace candle with cramp? What if your mind causes a painful muscle tension or spasm? This is one hypothetical mechanism for some kinds of pain, and just as scientifically mysterious and uncertain. In this case, the links between mind and pain are more unconscious and subtle. You might have no awareness of the intermediate muscle cause between your mind and your pain, which makes it seem a lot more like mind-powered pain. Such ideas may partly explain how the mind can be involved in causing pain, but without actually generating it from scratch. And they may also help to convince people that psychogenic pain is a legit phenomenon. But they're clearly not examples of pure psychogenic pain. A biological mechanism is still needed. The problem may have begun with a thought and ended with a perception, but the flesh still got involved in the middle, even if you couldn't tell. Okay, last section. If we can paralyze ourselves, we can probably make ourselves hurt. Functional neurological disorders definitely exist, and they seem closely related to psychosomatic pain. The FNDs were formerly known as conversion disorders, making it abundantly clear that the mind has some dramatic powers. We can experience seizures, paralysis, blindness, and other neurological symptoms in the absence of neurological disease. Strange, but true. And if we can paralyze ourselves with our minds, we can probably invent it too. In fact, some chronic pain might actually be one of the members of the FND family, just undiagnosable because pain can have so many other causes. In contrast, seizures, paralysis, and blindness have relatively short lists of possible causes to eliminate, leaving only the power of the mind to explain the problem. And so, once again, no one really knows. But inference from FNDs might be the most compelling clue that pure psychosomatic pain is possible. Still not perfect, though. As I mentioned above, the FNDs as a class don't seem to generally involve perceiving things that aren't there, any type of perception. As the name suggests, they're mostly about changing how we work, how we function, what we do with our nervous systems, not what we perceive with them. Also, another problem here with inferring psychosomatic pain from FNDs is that if FNDs can cause pain, I'm not sure there's actually any difference between that and psychosomatic pain. A functional neurological disorder that involves one symptom, pain, that is psychosomatic pain. That's what we're talking about. It's just another way of saying psychosomatic pain. So you can't use it to argue that psychosomatic pain exists. We don't know that an FND with a symptom only of pain exists, just like we don't know that psychosomatic pain exists. We can only infer from the other better known, the other known types of FNDs. That maybe if we can paralyze ourselves, we can also make ourselves hurt. That's broadly plausible. That's the compelling part. But we just flat out don't know if it also applies to creating pain out of nothing. We just don't know. And that is as far as I'm going to get with this topic today, which is pretty far. I am well aware of at least a dozen more subtopics I did not tackle here, and I could keep chipping away at this for weeks before sharing, but I'd rather share it now. I am really looking forward to the crowdsourcing here. I want your comments, your suggestions, and your criticisms. The final product will be much better for it. And I know that there are people who are reading this right now who are screaming, or listening to this, who are screaming. probably silently, because I've missed some critical thing, and because the belief in psychosomatic pain is passionate. People really strongly believe this, in spite of hating the all-in-your-head diagnosis. There's very strong pro-psychosomatic pain camp. I know you're out there. I know you're listening. So tell me why I'm wrong. Tell me how we know. Don't tell me that you're confident. Just talk to me about the reasons. How do we know that psychosomatic pain is real? And I think if you honestly try to answer that question, you will find it as difficult as I have. I'm not declaring that it isn't possible. My mind is not made up. I do not know the answer to this. But I'm going to keep looking, and I look forward to doing it with your help.